drop the needle.
So what's up, guys?
Well, we gotta do the intro, so calm down.
Okay, sorry. Usa.
There we go. Now okay. We're ready.
What's up, everyone? Welcome to another episode of the Stage Right Podcast. Today, we have on one of our very close friends, amazing monitor engineer, and overall great guy, Malcolm, also known as Moonphases on Instagram. How are you
gentlemen,
doing?
Good, man. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Just sitting here in freezing cold Minnesota with a broken pipe in my apartment lobby.
Oh,
it's great.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me on, guys. I'm honored.
Oh, it's our fucking pleasure.
Dude, absolutely, man.
I wouldn't have asked me.
So, Lo, should we just jump right in with the big question?
Let's fucking jump right into this. So, over here at Stage Right, we do this little thing called the bagel question. So, on tour, you wake up, you're on the bus.
Yeah.
It's morning time or close to loading, maybe afternoon.
Yeah.
You're hungry for breakfast. You're scorched, searching the bus. You find some bagels. What do you put on your bagel?
You know, I gave this question lots of thought because there's two types of bagels, either sweet or savory. For sure, I would go with savory. So you're asking my perfect bagel, right?
Yes.
Okay. Choice. Okay. It's 100%. It's got to be an everything bagel. Okay.
Everyone goes.
Let's just
everything.
Start there.
Holy shit.
Everything bagel. And then some type of like savory cream cheese, like chive and onion or something like
Ooh,
that.
Ooh, another chive and onion. We got a repeat. Okay.
Okay. And then we take avocado and we cut it up and we kind of mash it like a spread as well.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And it gets better. We're going to do an egg. We're going to do some bacon. In a perfect world, some like candied bacon or something like that.
Ooh. Yeah,
oh, yeah.
A little fancy. Pepper edge. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Or you can add the pepper with like some arugula, some type of leafy green like that. And then...
Damn, you're fancy.
Bagel sandwich. Man. I am fancy. Oh, if you didn't know, I'm pretty fancy, dude.
We need to get Malcolm on our bus, dude. Yeah. It's amazing.
For some reason, I guess I'm a bit high maintenance on tour. With no shame. Zero shame.
Me neither, yeah. We've been told this before, right, Chris?
Oh, yeah. We've been called out a few times for being a little high maintenance the rider.
Just trying to get some water over here. Hey.
Chris, I'm curious. What's your bagel?
All right. So this has been a big, like, controversial subject that I think has been misconstrued a bit.
Okay.
When we first started the podcast, I said cinnamon raisin and strawberry cream cheese.
Excellent. Excellent.
It's a bagel I love, but it's not the only bagel I love. It's just one of them. So I will go lox all day long.
For sure.
I'm not a big everything guy, though. I'll go sesame. So I would do sesame lox.
There's sesame on an everything bagel.
Yeah.
I know there is, but it's too much sometimes.
Yeah, for sure.
And then at home, I'll even sometimes go really crazy and do scrambled eggs with bacon on the cinnamon raisin bagel.
On a cinnamon raisin. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you got the sweet and savory.
Exactly. You kind of get them mixed together in like one little perfect package.
Yeah. Cool. Okay.
Okay.
I respect that.
Okay. Okay.
It's a good move.
And then Los goes everything. Los is always everything.
I go everything.
That's my guy right there.
Everything locks.
You can't discriminate. I like all the seeds. Just pile them on.
Just throw them on there.
Do you guys have Brugger's bagels where you're at?
No.
Damn, that's a travesty.
Is it?
That's the spot.
Yeah,
that's the spot, dude.
Yeah, fire bagels.
It's a travesty. It's out there in LA with no choices. Oh my God, Chris. You're funny, dude.
No, in Minnesota, Brugger's is the spot. That's where you go.
I do enjoy a bagel, but I don't like actively go out and like search, you know, for bagels, like gourmet bagels. I'm not a bagel connoisseur by any means.
Okay, that's fine.
You know,
what about like coffee? Is that do you search for on tour?
Definitely a big coffee guy. Okay. Yeah, any really good like craft, you know, pour overs or either pour overs or really good espresso.
Yes.
But I gotta have coffee every day. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Dude, yeah, it's rare to meet someone that's out on the road that's like, no, I don't, just don't drink coffee. You know what I mean?
I run 100% on coffee.
Yeah.
100%. Oh, man.
Yeah. That was gasoline. The best part of my European tour is like my European tour, like every bus we had, had like an amazing like cappuccino machine like that would froth the milk and do the whole nine yards on the bus. So every morning you'd wake up to like a perfect cappuccino you'd drink and then do load in.
Dude, those buses come incredible. With like a proper espresso machine with like a milk frother instead of like a Mr. Coffee or,
yeah, it's or like a Keurig or something.
Yeah.
Which I do appreciate the convenience of a Keurig, but you know, it's not like...
It's not the same.
It's appreciated, yeah, but...
Yeah. It's appreciated.
You spend the $20 more.
Yeah. I was bringing my AeroPress on tour, which was nice, but it's just like sometimes a hassle just finding beans because I go through a pound of coffee so fast, you know? And then once you bring like a really good coffee, like everyone wants them. And then all of a sudden it lasts for like a day or two. So
I lost my AeroPress and I'm so mad about it. I have to go get another one because those things are fucking amazing, especially for tour. They're like crucial. There's nothing better than that. Yeah.
Agreed.
It's as good as it gets.
Agreed.
All right. Well, this is not a food podcast, even though it kind of seems like it. Let's move past it.
It's a dangerous question to start with because it always derails, man.
I know, but before we started the recording, we were talking about calling this episode Fake It Till You Make It. Do you want to talk about like what that means to you and how you started and how much you faked and how much you faked it?
Still faking it. Still faking it. You know, I feel like... I kind of got thrown into the touring world, you know, pretty suddenly with my background. And my first tour was such a big tour with, you know, a big band. As you guys know, it's Revolution.
That was your first tour?
That was my first bus tour. So they definitely took a gamble and, you know, believed in me. I grew so much with them and I appreciate them a ton. But, you know, every tour, I just learn new things that I take along with me. And, you know, even if it's the slightest thing, if I can take away, you know, anything from a tour, it just helps me now. So I just build off each tour and different engineers and crew guys that I work with. And I'm basically like a culmination of stuff I've learned from, you know, a ton of different people.
So talk about how that started. Like, how did you even get into audio and link up with Revolution? Because that's a pretty great first run.
Yeah. So it's an interesting story. Was always into playing music and recording myself in middle school and high school. Didn't actually realize it was a career option. You know, until after I graduated, I had no idea, man. It blew my mind. My one of my best friends, he went to LA Recording School, and he got a job at Third Encore, which is a rehearsal studio here in Burbank, as you guys are aware.
Oh yeah, we did a live episode over there.
Yeah, for sure. So I went to I was living in San Diego at the time, and went to their city college. They had a program called Music Technology. And that's where I learned kind of all the basics like signal flow and, you know, the components of a microphone and such. I did that for about a year and they offered an internship at a live venue in downtown San Diego. It's called 4th and B. Not sure if you guys, it's closed down now. It was kind of a shady spot run by interns, you know, working for free. But I put in a ton of time there. I worked there for about a year for free. And my buddy offered me a job at Third Encore. And, you know, I was already thinking of moving back home to LA, moved back and worked at Third Encore for a few years, met Revolution and met a ton of the contacts I know today. You know, I'm super grateful for being able to call Third Encore my home. And, you know, Brian, I had worked with Brian, tour manager for Revolution for, I had known him for about a year or two before he asked me to go on tour with him. So I think he saw that I had the drive and, just gave me that chance.
I think a big thing we talk about is schooling versus actually having real world experience, how do you think that schooling helped you? Like, do you think it would have been better if you had just been thrown into like a, you know, trial by fire environment, or did that schooling really benefit you?
No, I learned everything I know totally on the field, man. I mean, you know.
Yeah, you can only read a book so many times. I think with this kind of stuff, it helps. I think it's a great base to build on with school and your teachers and, you know, the gear that you're able to use. But dude, until you get out on the road and make mistakes and fuck shit up and meet people and talk to all your peers, like, you're not going to develop as much ever in a schooling situation versus...
I'm always curious because I never hit a recording school. Like, I went to a studio and interned and then went to a band house and lived in a 4-story band house, just like recording on tape, just like fucking up constantly and just learning slowly. And everyone's always told me that's the best way to do it. So it's interesting to talk to you two who have both been to like proper recording schools and to see how that experience went for you.
I don't think there's a right or wrong way, like I've said.
That's true.
You know, I think everyone just has a different path and, you know, you just use what you get to your advantage. But like I said, touring is probably the best schooling you can ever learn from.
Right. I mean, especially in live sound where you need to be on the field, you need to make those mistakes. You need the repetition. You need to learn how to manage your time, manage different people, manage your relationships with local guys, crew guys, and your artist. I mean, that it doesn't come, you know, it might come naturally, but you definitely need practice.
Yeah, there's an element of psychology definitely to this gig, especially as a monitor engineer.
For sure, 100%. And, you know, I've made lots of strides. So this, you know, right before COVID hit. So 2019 was for sure my best year. And it was me realizing that it was a lot more of the psychological aspect and accepting that and honing in on that. So I work more with the artist directly as far as like talking to them, conversating, asking what they want from me, asking what they want in the music, and, you know, them helping me bring that experience to them versus me just kind of going through the motions. And like, rather than just mixing, I'd rather it be a collaborative effort, you know, with myself and the artist.
Yeah, you're setting yourself up for success, Gwen. When you can talk to your artist and have those conversations, man, it's amazing. And I don't see why you shouldn't be doing that as an engineer or as a tech. And
I think that's what it is. It's a team, you know, it's the artist and their crew. And, you know, everyone needs to be in sync and have the same goals. So if I'm joining a new camp, I'll kind of feel it out for a little bit and see how the artist works and how I can interact with them. And then I'll start kind of just sneaking myself in there as far as, you know, just being more vocal. I find, you know, we're all human beings. So is the artist. And there's no reason why I can't walk straight up to another human and ask a question or, you know. And usually my question is like, How did you feel? Like, what did you think of your mix tonight? You know, how can I make it better? And I feel like the artists, one, appreciate me asking, and the artist appreciates me treating them like, you
another
know,
another human being.
Another human being rather than just being scared or, you know, where they have management and yes,
yeah,
men and fans
through the
always
ladder.
Like, yeah. Exactly. And I feel like that's benefited me a ton this year. That's like the breakthrough I made in 2019.
Yeah, that's awesome. And then also, you made a pretty big change, I would say recently, but it's not because COVID has felt like a million years. But you left Revolution, an amphitheater touring band, to play with our dear friends, the Common Kings.
Yes.
Why did you make that transition, and how did that feel?
So with Revolution, I was mixing monitors, and the opportunity came for me to mix front of house, something I was, one, wanting to do, and two, deathly afraid of. And so the I believe it was the Good Vibe Summer Tour. It was Revolution, Stephen Marley, Common Kings, and I think there was a fourth band I'm forgetting who, I'm sorry, maybe Collie Buds or something. Anyways, the opportunity arose for me to, they were the second of four. They needed an engineer. You know, myself and the Revolution crew were so locked in. I had the time to spare. And I said, let me go for it, you know? So after that tour, Common Kings offered, you know, a headline tour with them. And it was just the right move for me to make. I was wanting to mix front of house, basically, is what it came down to.
Right. And what did that transition look like for you? Let's try to keep it kind of layman's terms, but going from monitors to front of house, like how did that change your workflow?
Definitely just trying to grow as an engineer, as a front of house mixer, as a mixing engineer, yeah. wanting to better the craft, wanting to be more creative. And
mix, you know, for you, I think, is a big part of it too, for front of house stuff, is you're mixing for what you want to hear. You're not catering to, you know, six people and their preferences.
Right. Right. And I'd always, you know, I loved, like, you know, big PAs and sound systems. I wanted to, like, just push some sound. So, you know, the Revolution was a fairly clean stage, and me being side stage and just, you know, hearing the crowd and hearing, you know, a K2 rig firing, like, I was like, I want to be out there, man. Like, I got to be out there. You know, there's something about being in front of house and you have a good mix, and, you know, there's nothing like it.
Nothing hits like a K2 and some KS-28 reference subs.
Oh,
you just,
man,
can't beat it.
Yeah, for sure.
I think having that opportunity to mix both sides of the snake is fantastic, dude. And
yeah,
I think when people don't take that chance, it's a shame, because like you said, you perfect the craft, you become a better engineer, you understand your team more as a whole, you understand what your monitor engineer needs or what your front of house engineer needs and the differences and, you know, sound coming off stage and et cetera, et cetera.
I get it. I mean, and both positions, you know,
Pros,
if you're
cons.
Mixing front of house, yeah. And if you're mixing front of house, it'll help you mix monitors and vice versa.
Absolutely,
you know?
Yeah.
Because you have to mix in you know, even more, you have to mix in different ways, you have to mix in different positions, you know. Yeah. I might be having a good show at front of house, my guy at monitors might be having a bad show. It's like just adapting to that. It gives you more tools.
You're just, yeah, you're more aware, have more perspective, and gain experience, exactly. Yeah. That's cool, man. I love hearing people just changing it up and taking risks, because I feel like that's something that I've done, you know, and it's given me the ability to work with a lot of cool artists and bands that way. And
yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I also respect and look up to people that have been with particular artists for many, many years, and that's great.
Right.
But for me, I grow more and perfect my craft. And if I'm able to come back later on, like I did with Liration and other artists, it's great, because you come back like more refined and with all this other experience.
Absolutely.
And I gotta shout out my time with Revolution. You know, my first tour, I'm learning from Errol Brown.
Oh my God, you got to tour with him?
Yeah, man.
What
it was my
sweet
first
soul. Oh,
yeah, dude. That dude is like, he's legendary. He's great to work with, great to learn from.
Talk more about him. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, for sure. So, you know, I huge shout out. This show, I'm just going to be shouting out all the people I learned from, because I'm you know, super, super grateful. There's been a few engineers that have taken me under their wing. It seems like every threshold, there's been someone, like some type of mentor there. And Errol Brown definitely was one. And unfortunately, I was fairly green. So I was just kind of trying to figure myself out and learn how to tour, like on and off stage. So I think I would have learned more from him now. But from him, it's just, I learned from him, like, you don't need like 10,000 plugins to mix a really good show. It's like, he was just unbelievable. You know, he mixed pretty loud, but that's a subjective thing, whatever. But I mean, as far as a reggae mixing artist, I mean, wow. He's one of the best, you know. And definitely learning how to understand like the Jamaican accent. It was like a crash course, bro. And moving transition, and also Joe King, legend, love that King. Guy. Shout out King, love you,
my
man.
Main man. Shout out King,
my main man. I mean, I learned so much from him, and he's like one of the best human beings I've ever met, and also extremely professional and really good at what he does. And that Revolution crew, like we all got along so well. And everyone was super good at their jobs, and we had great, great times for sure. But transitioning to Common Kings, during that summer tour, Stephen Marley's engineer, front of house engineer Veer, I don't know if you guys know him, but he kind of took me under his wing. So I'll never forget one of the first shows I was mixing with Common Kings. You know, I've got huge PA I'm dealing with. I'm just trying to kind of fake it till I make it. And he comes, so we start this show instantly. Something's feeding back. I mean, I'm talking about start a show, unmute everything. Something's feeding back. And he comes running to front of house. He's like, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing? I'm like, he's like, your floor tom's feeding back. And I was like, oh, there it is. I muted it. And he's like, you know what? I'm going to help you out. And that whole summer, he kind of just stood next to me at front of house and, you know, showed me his techniques. And I learned from him, you know, so many things.
What are like the top five things that you got from him, like mixing tips or anything for front of house?
One, he gave me a lot of tips for tuning PA, using like dynamic processes such as, you know, compression or EQing on my drum channels and such. And what I really took from Veer is he worked really well with his artists. So that's where I first was exposed to the front of house engineer working directly with the artist and also recording my shows. He's like, you record all your shows, dude, record and listen. So that's when that was a huge game changer for me.
Hearing your references and growing that way. Yeah.
Right. And now I do that all the time. Now I just record everything, and I record, if I'm mixing in front of house, I'll record and give it directly to the artist that same night, you know, and have them give me notes. You know, there is that trust, but I want to be transparent, and, you know, I have, you know, more confidence now to know I'm doing a fairly good job. So it's like, this is what it is. Like, more, just give me notes of what you want from me.
Absolutely. I think it's something that shows drive, man, that you want to keep just growing and perfecting the show until the smallest, most minuscule detail is perfected. But then the audience just has such an incredible experience. Something to feel proud of, that you built that with your artists and your crew. And man, I don't know. I miss that. I miss that feeling. And
you're making me sad right
now. How rewarding that is. Yeah, fuck. I think that's why we love it.
And just putting yourself in the hot seat. You know, I first started doing that with Common Kings. So Veer helped me with that whole, with Common Kings during the summer. And then I was kind of, you know, he set me free. I mixed their headline tour. And Common Kings was great because it was a family vibe. I love the music, but they definitely expected a high quality product. They were definitely, you know, and we all grew together for sure.
They know what they want, and they, you know, they expect a certain level
And shout out Common Kings. Rest
shout out
in peace,
Common
Drew.
Kings. Yeah. Love yeah, for sure. Boys. And you know, they wanted a, you know, big reggae mix, but they wanted this pop vibe, and they wanted it clean. They had a ton of channels. They had playback. They did expect a lot from me, which was great because, you
makes
know,
you
and it made me grow. And, you know, that first tour recording my set, and they would literally go on the bus and, like, you know, play my track on a Bluetooth speaker with the band sitting next to me. And the first, you know, the first few mixes weren't that good. And it was just like pretty brutal, you know. Not that they were bad, but they weren't great, you know?
Yeah. No, it's just the first ones aren't going to be the greatest right away, as proud as you might feel them, especially when you're showing it to your artist that they know their songs, their music, and where the level should be. You're going to hear a lot, especially coming into a new band that you haven't really mixed or worked with before. You can always prepare yourself. I always say, like, try to ask for a set list and make a Spotify playlist or buy the tracks and just try to memorize everything that you can, you know, get that sound engraved in your ears. And that's a good base to start off from. Always, like, and also, like, build a file if you can and,
yeah, definitely,
and all that. But until you get out there and mix the show and hear back from your artist, man, you're faking it
until you make it.
Yeah. That's a great technique, man. I saw that for the very first time when I toured with Prince, and he would have like the entire show recorded in video and audio, obviously. And as soon as like the last note was hit, like you had to bounce that shit down.
Oh, wow.
And hand it over to the production manager, and he would take it to him, and he would watch and hear the show that same night after he just played a set.
That's crazy.
Every night.
That's crazy. It also shows their dedication too, you know?
Yeah. No, that he was a master of his craft, man. I it was unbelievable to see that. And
wow,
he would have notes for everybody. Video team, audio team, lighting.
Mm-hmm.
That man was a legend. When I met him, like, just the things he was saying to his front house engineer, it was unreal. Like, he knew every in and out of that board. Like, but not even that. Like, he knew all the technical aspects. Like, he was questioning why certain things are pre-fader versus post-fader. Like,
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he'd go up to the board and, like, start changing with the EQ and, like, the attack release on the gates. Like, he knew what he was doing. Like, when I got hired for that, they basically told me, like, if he could do all the positions, if this man could clone himself, he would and do everything.
Just have a crew of himself.
He could.
Dude, like, he could mix. He could play all the instruments. I mean, wow. It's
amazing.
Incredible. Incredible to witness that.
Yeah, he's so... I think we've talked this before, but I played with him at Paisley Park because we installed a quadraphonic L-acoustics rig at Paisley Park. And he came to test it out. And he just got up and said, "Can anyone drum?"
I said,
"Kinda." And he said, "All right, well, get up here." And for 30 minutes, we just like swapped instruments on stage so we could test this system out. So I played drums with him, played bass with him, played guitar with him.
That's amazing. Wow.
And he was in a one-piece gray tracksuit, like skin tight, with light-up high-heel sneakers.
were you more excited or were you kind of like shitting bricks at that moment?
I didn't even... At that point, I was so young. I was probably 19.
Wow.
I didn't know what the fuck was going on. So I was just kind of rolling with it. I was just trying to do my job.
You're just playing.
then when I left, I like kind of like broke down hysterically laughing. I was like, holy fuck, that actually just happened. I just jammed with Prince for 30 minutes.
As a native Minnesota.
As a native Minnesotan.
Sure, that's surreal, man.
Yeah,
and it's funny,
sure,
too, the system tech that I was there with, after that was over, he looks at me and goes, "Dude, you know what just happened, right? Do you realize that? Do you realize what you just did?"
Oh, man.
You're like, no. Yeah. Awesome.
Shit.
Awesome.
Malcolm.
Yeah.
You're going on tour. You're packing your Pelican.
Yeah.
What are your essentials? What do you got in
there? Wow. Nice. Okay. Well, I got my... all my adapters, my cable tester, let's see, my Leatherman, my flashlights, headlamp, a few DIs, a few, like my switch mic, my two pairs of in-ears, my IEM cleaner.
Nice.
Now, some hand sanitizer.
A couple of 95s.
Yeah. No, seriously, man. It's, you know, I've still been working, you know, thank God, during the shutdown. And honestly, that's kind of like the new role as a monitor engineer. You're like the COVID compliance you know, you got to keep the stage clean and sanitized. So
yeah, for sure.
You know, and I'm excited to adopt that, you know, like it's kind of stuff we maybe should have been doing, just a little more cleanliness and, you know, wipe those caps off a little more often.
Yeah. So I got, yeah. So no cue box in there.
Oh yeah, for sure. Cue box. I've got a few like the rat, like the sniffers. Yeah, that thing saved my life a few
great
times.
Great fucking tools. Yeah, shout out Sound Tools. They're amazing.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And
cat boxes.
Oof. Oh, for sure. I've got one of those. Shout out. Yeah, they sent me a bunch of stuff. Thanks, guys.
We love your rat sound.
Yeah, that's in like my 15. That's in my smaller Pele. That's kind of like my essentials there.
Nice. You know? I love it.
And maybe like a mug and my AeroPress too, I'll throw on there just in case.
And a screwdriver set. Come on.
Come on.
Oh, yeah. My precision kit. Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Goes for the AeroPress before the screwdriver.
I would too. It's okay. No judgment.
White.
Yeah, that was in order of priority.
Yeah.
In order of priority there.
For me, it's kind of like gain structure, like coffee first.
Stage right. Stage right, baby.
Stage right, baby. That's why we're both in there. Now I have space for my coffee. Oh, man.
Well, should we talk about gear? Talk about some consoles, plugins?
Okay.
Sure. Where do we start?
Okay, let's talk consoles first. What are your go-to, like, top two? If like your choice A, and obviously if for whatever reason, preference or price, you can't get your choice A, what's your choice B?
I'm definitely a Digico guy. If it's whatever budget, I'd go for a Quantum 7 these days. If you got a Quantum series, you don't even need a Wave server or anything like that. You can make that thing sound great.
Yeah.
second choice, I mean, so we're going Digico from a big Surface to an SD12 would be my second choice. And right behind that is an SXL. I toured with SXL all of 2019 with Andy Grammer, who I did monitors for. And it took me a year to get super, super comfortable on it. But the automation, and it sounds great. And I was flying on it. And it's a beautiful desk, too.
What are your comparisons between the SD12 and the SXL? I'm just curious to see like what you favor more in one or the other. Pros and cons, I guess.
Yeah, good question. If I'm on a SD rack with the standard input cards, I gotta kind of give the edge to the SXL. I think their preamps, the newer preamps, sound amazing. But as far as it's so close, man, because my Digico workflow is so dialed in. I have it customized, and we kind of brushed on like, and maybe we could talk about it later, being prepared, but like my show file, I take so much pride in my show file. Dude, I'll spend like 8 hours creating my show file because I'm so OCD, just having everything labeled and placed where I want. And, even like channels being next to each other. So Digico takes the edge for me. And if I'm in a, you know, when I'm in a real-world situation, it's probably the workflow. Because SXL is a little weird to navigate at times, you know.
I'll say that, yeah. I think Digico, you can, like you said, you can set it up more custom how you really want it. And yeah, I think it sounds a little bit more colorful and fun. SXL, for me, it's like a little, you know, you can sauce it up with the plugins. But Digico, like right off the bat, sounds pretty good.
Yeah. I agree.
So as not a monitor engineer, I remember when I was on a Blues Traveler tour and we had Digicos as our touring rig. And we went to a fly date and it was a SC-48. And I couldn't believe the difference. Like when I went back on the actual tour and we had the Digicos, it was like, holy fuck, this sounds amazing. And that was before I had proper ears. I was just on 515s. And the difference, it was unbelievable. They sound so fucking good.
Right. Yeah. And I've taken my my SC48 starting file and have loaded it onto an SXL. And because there's so much more bandwidth and the preamps are so much cleaner, like it'll try and compensate. So if you open your SC48 file, like all your compression is going to be super exaggerated. So like it's just more information. Well, kudos for you, Carlos. I know on the Iration tour, you're on that Midas console.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've mixed on it several times, and I'm not going to knock it, but just as far as workflow, like if I'm going to spend a few months behind a console, it's just not my first choice.
No. With Iration, it's more of like they own their gear, so they don't rent anything. So for that, it's more of like a this is what we got type situation, which, you know,
yeah.
I think it's all right. They sound great, but like you said, the workflow isn't the best, I think. And, you know, you're pretty limited with outputs. So we're literally at capacity with outs. And
you're totally maxed out, huh?
Maxed out, even with channels, like... It's a whole process when we have like guests or, you know, we want to add something for a special festival.
It's so bad.
Or whatever.
It's always like, hey, we got a guest tonight. It's like, oh, fuck.
Yeah, that's
where we're going to put it.
Kind of like roping up the rack. And yeah, dude, it's, I think it's, I mean, before that, they used to have a M32. So that was a huge jump, you know, in sound. But,
right.
But right. Yeah, I would, if I could, I would definitely go Digico with them.
That seems like the standout for everyone we ask that question to is Digico. And I completely agree. Digico just sounds, and I would love to know like what it is, what in their like A to D algorithm makes it sound so warm, but they're just fucking amazing consoles.
Yeah. I feel like we've only heard like Digico top and like a close second SXL. And like, maybe we had one person that said SX. Yeah. We had Jay Wiz that said SXL.
No one said Yamaha, which kind of pisses me off because I grew up with Yamaha.
You know, although I did recently mix on their new PM10, the Rivage, and it was excellent. It sounded great. And if you know how to mix on a CL console, you can easily transition. But it's totally just preference, you know, and I feel totally at home with Digico.
And I think it's also the application, because I grew up mixing on Yamaha's in corporate environments, which the Dan Dugan plugin, which is an auto mixer. So when someone's not talking, it'll pull down the other mic or pull down that mic and let only the person who's talking mic be prevalent. And it just works so well in those environments. And you can't get that Dan Dugan without buying a super expensive card for any other console, you know? So, but it is all preference, like with DAWs too, with recording programs, they really do all sound so similar. It's just what is going to be the best for your workflow and how you work.
Yeah. It's kind of like there's all sorts of painting brands and you choose which one you like better.
There's all kinds of bagels. You know, you just got to do what you do.
Yeah.
Digico is my everything bagel. It's got
everything. That's the quote. That's the quote right there. Oh, I love it.
So what do you do for plugins? Like, what's your workflow as far as plugins go in your console?
Good question.
Let's start with drums.
Okay, so drums... So I mostly use plugins now, for especially on the Digico, because I'm not the biggest fan of their onboard effects as far as like their verbs and their delays and such. So I generally will use plugins like such as Waves. I'll use like Arverb or like the Waves Abbey plate. So I use Yeah. And you know, these days I'm stacking like four reverbs for my whole drum kit and kind of stacking them on. So yeah, I generally gravitate toward like the reverbs and delays and stuff now and try and make the best of the onboard dynamic.
So are you stacking verbs on your master bus for the drums?
So it'll be, I'm giving away some secrets here, but, you know, I might have two verbs. It'll either be giving myself options. So I'll have like a plate
different
and a
colors.
Hall from, yeah, different yeah. colors. Exactly. So it'll be a plate and hall for my snare. These days I'll throw my toms into their own verb.
Yep.
And I've learned a cool trick where I will throw the whole kit in like a small room. And again, you're just coloring and you're layering them on. And it's very subtle, but it'll, you know, it just makes the kit sound so big. And it just gives you more options too, versus just having, you know, I used to just throw my snare in a hall and just be happy with that.
Interesting. And then you're also on a, I know Common Kings is on Kempers now. So I've gotten many a call from Mata trying to set his Kemper up.
Yeah, he recently switched over, which that's, you know, I'm so glad to see it.
Yeah, so how are you handling those? And what do you think about the Kemper as far as like from a front of house perspective?
I love the Kempers, man. I mean, you get a stereo guitar signal. It's always very consistent if the player or tech spends the time to level everything out. I think they're super reliable, minus, you know, I've seen some issues with, you know, long Ethernet runs or usually the remote. But I'm a huge fan. And it also, you know, I don't have a huge amp on stage. Just
points it directly at you. Yeah.
Exactly.
And just, you know, just for anyone who's wondering, to talk about that long Ethernet run, you need to have power over Ethernet for those Kempers, because they will not function over, I think, 25 feet unless you have that power injection into the Ethernet cable.
And I remember on our rep tour when they switched over, our guy having to learn that, you know, the hard way. Although we tried using it for Marley 2 on bass, and it just wasn't the same as an actual Ampeg. We couldn't mimic it, you know. And Errol Brown wasn't a fan. So he was a fan of the Kempers for guitars, but not for bass.
It's different for bass. I do think that Kemper is kind of, and I'm sorry, I love you Kemper so much, but they've fallen short a bit on their bass presets. They just don't feel the same like the B15N. They haven't captured that gorgeous roundness that amp actually has in real life. So they have to work on that. But for guitars, I mean, I think they're just fantastic. I still think Fractal has a bit of an edge, because they're using the Shark processors that UAD uses in their Apollo Twins and all their interfaces.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, but the workflow on the Kemper, I think, is bar none, because I used Kempers for a long time on Blues Traveler. Or sorry, Fractals on Blues Traveler. And their menu structure is really, really confusing. There's so many options, and it's so hard to find some of those options. But Kemper has made it so simple to walk into it, like just like blind-eyed and just set up a great, great set list.
Right. It even seems, based on like the Fractal remote controller, you know, it's like, it looked a bit more complicated than the Kemper.
It's much more complicated to program, for sure. Kemper has done a great job making a very simplistic menu structure that you can use.
Needless to say, I know the guys who, Eric Rachmani with Revolution, he took his Kemper home and spent a lot of time dialing his sounds, which just helps me out too, you know.
For sure.
I think there's like less room for error that way. Like if you're starting with a good sound right off the bat off the Kemper, then you need to do way less things. Like if all the levels are right and it sounds great, then, you know, you don't really have to touch the compression and minimal EQ if it needs it. And
that just comes down to a discussion between the guitar tech and the monitor guy. Like Los and I have had a million times, like changing patch levels, changing, you know, graph QQs on some of my, especially my acoustic patches.
If you're a monitor engineer, you're a guitar tech, and your techs on stage need to be your homies, dude.
For sure. You know,
100%.
Yeah. And that goes more into the communication thing. Like just talking with the artist and saying like, hey man, your levels are all out of whack. Like, can we spend some time and go through every patch and make sure they're leveled correctly, you know, and they should be, you know? Yeah. Back to your question. I think my favorite plugin right now, honestly, is probably the F6 though, because I can throw that on just about anything.
That's on every one of my podcast tracks. Yeah. I F6 everything.
Yes. Awesome.
That is in my top five for sure.
But I don't have the RTA, which is unfortunate, because the new version has the RTA built in, which is,
it's so good, dude. That's epic. What makes it like amazing. It's a great sounding EQ and multi-band compressor and everything, but having that RTA is like such a helpful tool, when especially when you have just a certain frequency that's like bugging you, and in live sound especially, you can just look at it and grab it right away.
Yeah, which is funny, because I feel a little bit like it's cheating to see the RTA sometimes, because I'd rather I could like just pick out that frequency right away. But also.
It just helps with accuracy and also confirm your whatever. Like by the time you're getting to that plug-in, like you should be thinking already what frequency that is. And
100%.
When you're like, oh, it's probably like, you know, 2.6. And then you get to the plug-in and you see 2.6 or 3 and you're like, nice.
That's definitely like one of the best feelings for sure. You're like, ah, I still got it.
I still got it.
But they're all tools in the toolbox, man. And like, you know, plugins used to get a lot of slack from like kind of old school guys. And I think if you know how to use a plugin well, you know, I think you should be really well with a handful of plugins and just know them inside and out. And that's just tools in your toolbox. It's not like a, you know, it's not a cheat or anything. Same with the RTA, man. Like if I'm, you know, ringing wedges out at a festival and I think I'm pretty close, I'll still have my RTA out for reference. I'm not trying to guess and waste more time. You know, it's all just tools. Why not use them? You know,
right.
There's no shame. There's no shame in that. Just it's all, you know, to do a good job.
Yeah. On tour and in life, I'm a big fan of tools that save you time. So
yeah.
Why not use
them? So what's plugin number two?
Plug-in number two.
I'm going to see if you and I can go like tit for tat on every single plug-in.
Okay. Well, let's pull out a compressor then. Probably the API 2500. I have a lot of success with that, with either on my master bus or on my outputs for my ears. It's pretty versatile. And I even throw that like on a drum parallel group or something like that.
Dude, it gives a lot of whatever you're putting it on. Obviously, great coloring, but the imaging, I feel like it also adds this sort of like round space to whatever you're using it on.
Mm-hmm. And you can dial it in, you know, with, and I love like the new and old presets and stuff like that. Just different flavors and different color.
Versatile. Love that.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
What about a limiter as we're talking about compression?
Probably L3.
Yes. That's what I was waiting for, because I rock L3 Ultra Max on all my master buses.
Yeah. And I often, you know, I'll record my shows and just I'll kind of like polish them a bit, and I always throw that on there to give to the band. Yeah, so these days they're like, it always sounds great. I'm like, yeah, sure. Put a little secret sauce on there.
All right, what about while you're giving up secrets, what about your secret sauce for vocals?
Secret sauce for vocals. Let's see. I'm a big fan of parallel processing right now. Parallel processing. So that's been my secret sauce these days.
Let's layman's that a bit. So we're talking two channels here.
Correct. So you'll have one channel with some corrective EQing and, you know, maybe some boosting in whatever range is needed. And you'll take a second channel, duplicated of the vocal, and you'll compress that more than you would the dry. And then you blend that in. So it's a wet and dry signal, essentially. And that gives so much more, if done correctly, it can give you just more beef.
Presence.
More presence. Yeah.
And are you achieving this through making just a copy channel, or are you doing it through like a group, VCA, or?
I'm doing it through groups.
Okay.
Yeah. So I, you know, shout out to an engineer I'm working with right now. His name's Mark Woodcock. He's a Clair guy. And he showed me how he groups his files, and it was a total, like, it's so easy. Yeah, it just totally blew my mind. So I'm mixing a lot with groups. So I have, you know, a front of house mix. I might have like 12 or more groups, even if it's not that big of a band. And I do a lot of my shaping and coloring to the groups, and a ton of parallel processing as well, all through groups, to answer your question.
Okay. Yeah. And are you doing this for monitors as well, or?
Unfortunately, no. I refrained from groups on monitors. I haven't found a console that I'll be able to really achieve that and be as fast, you know.
Totally. Yep. Yeah, I think it just, in monitor world, it adds another layer of digging through when, you know, if you're in a pinch and I like to keep things a little bit more simple for monitor, but for front of house, yes, groups are essential, man. And yeah. I find myself kind of being on that section of the console more than touching channels. Like if you dial in your mix in great and you have a file, you should kind of just be making small little movements in your group section and working on that, you know, coloring and working on those versus flying through channels, you know, back and forth.
Right. And so now I'll usually stay on my VCAs. So I'm kind of mixing with both. So I create the overall mix with the groups. And if there's any subtle movements or a solo or minor level changes, I'll do that with the VCAs. But my groups are my blend. And any changes are through my VCAs or individual channels. You're doing the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a great way to work. Yeah.
Yeah, and with the grouping, you can, you know, so I have a group for my kick. You do some corrective EQing on your however many kick mics you have. They get summed into a group. And then you can do, corrective EQing or whatever you need to do on the sum of both of your kicks. And by having more groups, you're able to do more either correction or shaping. So my kick's in a group, my snare's in a group, my tom's in a group, my overheads are in a group. And I could just clean everything up, you know, so much more than just having a drum group.
Totally. Yeah.
You get what I'm saying? It's
more cohesive that way. Yeah.
Totally. Right. And also, so your original question was asking me about vocals. So big fan of course, having a proper mic. Right now, most of my artists are using V7s. I know that's going to be your question. Shout out to SD. parallel processing and effects, man. I think what separates good and great engineers are their use of effects.
Yeah.
I think that's where, you know, you create a base with your mix. And then you color it and you let it shine with your effects. Either, you know, where it's, if it's a big moment of a show or it's like a crazy delay throw, but I think more subtle effects.
Yeah, that's where your creativity's at. Like your artist is giving you the raw signal and then you're kind of like painting on top with all those effects and, you know, compressors and tools of the trade.
So that's how I achieve a killer vocal mix as well. I might have, you know, I give myself options. I might use half of them. I may use all of them, but I might use, you know, I'll have like six effects for my vocals ready to go.
Yep.
And it could be verbs. It could be chorus. It could be doubler. I know I love a chorus, even if it's subtle, you know, it gives your vocal some movement. You might have a doubler to thicken it up. You have verb for space, and then you have delays too that create more space. So that's my secret.
I love it, man. Yeah. It's pretty much about the same that I do. Yeah. I like to have at least two and two, like two verbs, two delays. And...
Carlos, respect, recognize. game recognize game, bro. So I love subtly stacking effects, and on my effects returns, I'll do a ton of more shaping. And by shaping, I'm talking about EQing.
Yes.
So I'm just making space for everything to sit right where I want it. And the sum of all that together is magic. You know, it's magical.
I'm going to use all these tips because Los and I have a mix-off coming up for the next Pacific Dub single release. And we're going to both mix the acoustic track. And I'm going to take some of these tips.
Yeah, one little tip I do with my effects returns, I'll grab with the EQ, we're like right off the bat, I'll high pass either at 200 or close to 200 and then low pass down to like 8 or 7K.
Okay.
You go that low.
Sometimes 6. Yeah, depending on the effect, just to like, so it's that creating more space and sitting where I want it to. And then if it needs anything in the mids or, you know, higher mids, I'll mess with that, either a boost or a cut, usually a cut. But yeah, I learned that trick from a friend of mine, and it's like a super old school trick to just make your verbs and delay sound a little bit more interesting and not clash so much with your vocal. You're just giving your higher register more space to breathe versus like the delay also being there.
Right. Yeah. It's a good way to like brighten up your vocal too. You know, you'll rather than boost the high end on the actual vocal channel and, you know, potentially feedback, I might boost it in the reverb with a ton of pre-delay so you can still hear that shine, but not from the direct source.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know. And just, you know, before using your effects, you really think about what you're trying to achieve and just the thought behind it, you know. So now I'll do a lot of compression going into the effect aux. You know, I might, for example, that drum room verb, I might throw my drums and then compress the output where it sounds like a tight kit. And then send that into the verb. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And you know, just really using all the tools you have. I think a lot of people don't use consoles to their fullest potential, I see.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, man, you know, there's people that I see, you know, I've taken over files or just seen files that don't even have a high-pass filter engaged on, like, every channel. I'm like, what? You have them on every channel. Just use them. Like, even if you're down to like 20, 30 hertz, like, just turn it on and use it and clean shit up. Even if you're not hearing it, it's there to use it. Might as well.
I like doing that right off the bat too. Like on outputs or inputs, if I'm throwing any source into any type of processing, whether that be a filter or an EQ, let's say I have an EQ on my output of my matrix for the PA. So it's going into, you know, the EQ processing. I'll just turn on my EQs for all my matrices just to hopefully deal with less latency, you know, just have everything be in time. So if you're throwing a filter on one input and on another, like, it's just best to turn it on so they're all going through the same path, you know. Mm-hmm.
That's a great tip.
I like that you said that you're a fan of the microphone to start off to get a good vocal on your chain, man. I say that all the time. It all starts with the microphone after the source.
Yeah.
Just go through gain structure, man. Get a good microphone.
Right. Yeah, and that's another thing I learned from Veer. You asked me, it was
mic choice.
You know, he said he's always was like the source has to be good. He made Common Kings buy all new backline after their summer tour. He's like, that snare sounds like shit. Get a new one. That sounds like shit. Get a new one. It wasn't like just buy new gear because he's like, you need it to sound good at the source.
If this is how you want to sound, then this is what you need to get. Yeah.
Bro, you can't polish a turd. You know what I mean? Like,
And I'm a huge fan of, I learned from him, you know, proper mic selection and proper mic placement. And with those combined with a proper source, you don't have to do much.
Yeah.
You know,
it's not that hard. Yeah.
It's not. Like if you're hacking a channel to pieces on your EQ, it's probably the source.
Something's not right. Yeah.
Something's not right. So I transitioned from Common Kings to Andy Grammer, who's a pop artist, And that's, so Andy Grammer is where I fell back in love with mixing monitors. So I mix, so I honestly love both jobs. They're both so different. I absolutely love mixing monitors too, man.
Same.
And I had 16 stereo mixes, heavy snapshots, suddenly going from reggae to pop, doing TV shows and, you know, everything pop world, everything, you know, just throwing the pop world, high level of expectation as far as quality of mixes, tons of snapshots. The band knew about snapshots. So they were like, you know, they would ask me, you know, we had 2 weeks of full production rehearsals where they built the show from the ground up. And, you know, the band asking me like, hey, on this song, can you make a snapshot where this happens and then come out of that snapshot with this change? And it's like, oh my God.
Know too much.
I toured with an artist
too much.
That knew about snapshots. And it basically became that, like, oh, in the verse, can you do this? And then back in the chorus, do that. And like at the end of the song, can you boost this? And in this song, can you make the EQ sound like, dude? And it was a heavy pre-production.
Yeah.
For sure.
And I used to shy away from snapshots. I was always scared of pressing
next.
Cause I'm like, what's gonna happen? But you know, faking it till I made it, I learned how to use snapshots in a pinch. And even during a show, I can update a snapshot and, you know, I can update all or relative changes or whatever that might be. So, you know, again, one thing I took from that tour of many, and on that tour, I switched over to SXL and I worked with Ryan John. Shout out to Ryan John. He is, like the avid, product specialist. He designed the SXL. He's amazing. From him, I took,
Shout out Ryan.
He taught me how to time align all my channels. He started with the drums. And that was such a game changer for me. So aligning all your drums, all of a sudden, my most, you know, I might have a few cuts here and there, but essentially flat. And it's amazing. It's amazing.
Just kind of break down time aligning drums for everyone out here.
Sure. So we'll start with something easy. So you have a kick. You have two mics on one source. You have an inside mic. You have an outside mic. Person hits the kick. Which mic's going to get pick up that sound wave first? It's going to be the inside kick.
Exactly.
And then second is the outside kick. So you need to align both of your mics so that they, you know, are outputting at the same time. So I'll delay my inside kick to match the outside kick. Usually it's around 1 to 2 milliseconds. But when you line it up, and what I do is I'll slowly delay the inside mic while soloing both kick mics. And you can hear night and day right when it lines up. Boom. Mm-hmm. It sounds full. You get, it's the whole kick sound.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, you know, I'm just cutting a little 160, 200 on both. And kick sounds good. Yeah. And the sum of all that, I do the same with my two snare mics. So you'll delay one to the other, usually around, it's not much, just, you know. But right when you hear they line up, it's night and day. And what you can do is you can turn on and off your delay after you think you found it and hear the difference. What I sometimes do is exaggerate and do too much delay so I can hear them slap and I'll come back on it. And you can
until
hear
it
right
falls.
Now. Yep. It just, yeah.
And that's one thing we haven't actually talked much about on this podcast is phase, which is such a big part of engineering. And I know this has been a fairly techie conversation, but we should go into phase a little bit and what phase means and how phase affects a mix in any aspect, live or recorded.
Keep it in phase, baby.
So what we're talking about when he talks about a kick being really round and full is when phase is out of line, certain frequencies are canceled out. So when you're looking at a waveform, there's a line in the middle and there's things that go above the line and below the line. And theoretically, if when you have a hump above your middle point and a hump below the middle point at the exact same time, that will cancel out the phase exactly because the top is positive, the bottom is negative. So when you're trying to line up audio, you want to make sure that everything is completely in phase so no frequencies are being canceled out. And even if they're not directly opposite in time, they can still cancel out a subtle bit of that. And that will change the sound of your, you know, either two mics and the kick or even, you know, it could even be two guitars. Anything that is going to be opposite in phase is going to cancel out part of those frequencies if they're playing at the same time.
That was great. Good job, Chris. And generally that happens when you're, you know, at least in live sound, when you have multiple mics on one source.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's most likely like your kicks, your snares, like you said, maybe the guitar.
Or like a bass DI and a bass mic.
Yeah. And what's crazy is theoretically, if I had two speakers in the right placement, they were both playing 60 hertz tones and one was the opposite phase, I would hear nothing in the room. Yeah, yeah, nothing at all. Theoretically, which would probably never happen. I don't think it ever has. I've never seen it happen, but theoretically it would completely cancel out and be silent in the room, even though both speakers were like just pumping the fuck out of each other.
Right. And that's what makes a mix from good to great.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. That all comes with experience, I think, learning all that, especially phase.
Yeah, yeah.
Phase is crazy, man. Phase is a wild thing.
And I love it. And I'm not, you know, super technical with system tuning, but I love the idea of tuning a rig and making sure it's all in line and all in phase. And, you know, those guys, props to all the system engineers. They're always my best friend. And I've got a ton of respect for you guys. You know,
love you guys.
Fucking scientists, mad scientists.
Man, I worked, Coachella in 2019, and my system engineer was like a Russian mad scientist, bro. And he had his temperature meter and humidity reader, and he would make changes on different times of day when there's many people are there. It was great, you know.
I had a system tech, and I was asking him like, "So what are you doing, or why are you doing this?" When I was younger, and he would just tell me, "Fucking magnets, bro." Magnets. Who knows? Fucking magnets.
There's just something beautiful about when you like walk into like a amphitheater or a room and you just like barely, you know, you throw your songs on to tune the system and you barely have to do anything. Like right off the bat, it sounds great. And you just like, I just always look at the systems engineer like, wow, thank you. You're a fucking artist. Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, I know.
It's like, I fucking know. This is my room. It's like, it's amazing, I love when people take pride in what they do.
All right. So we've had a lot of conversations about how you've learned on the road, who's taught you, all these really amazing accomplishments that you've done. Let's talk about the worst times. What are some of your biggest fails on stage?
Okay. One that comes to mind is... So after Reb, I worked with this jazz group, Vince Wilburn, who's Miles Davis's nephew. Awesome. We were playing a show in Australia. I'm still, you know, new to touring, and you know they have a profile. I'm like, I'm going to build this epic show file. So I, you know, I build this show file, outputs everything, and one huge mistake I made was I added all these plugins that I didn't know how to use. I was just like cut and paste, add this, add that, doing what I thought was going to be needed. It's this huge festival called Byron Bay Blues Festival.
Blues Fest,
dude. I mean, and you know, it's a huge festival.
Huge, dude. This festival is amazing.
It's like the Coachella of Australia, Byron Bay, whatever.
Yep.
And man, so one we had the worst changeover. So this was a Miles Davis alumni band. It was all musicians who's played with Miles. There were 14 dudes on stage. It's just me. I'm the only crew guy. Ton of backline. we're already 10 minutes late. I go to front of house. I load this file that I think is just like super badass. I'm super proud. Literally, they're like 3, 2, 1, let's go. I unmute and everything feeds back so loud. So loud. And I couldn't find what was feeding back. And I had, the house, front of house guy, I had the tech screaming at me like, dude, get your shit together.
Oh my God.
I basically had to like one by one unmute channels that I knew were safe. And, by the time I got everything under control, it's like they were already half an hour in and on their last song.
Oh, God. Oh, man.
And it was just me and like literally, yeah, it was like a huge eye opening. And that was fairly early on in my career. And I was like, I don't ever want that to happen again.
You don't forget that. Yeah, you'll learn real quick.
Never. Wow. And actually, so I have another quick story, 2018 Coachella, something kind of similar, but this story will always stay with me. So we have Lizzo on our stage and she's just blowing up. She's the biggest artist of the year. She's playing Coachella Mojave stage. Before she even goes on, like the artist before ends and there's like the tent is full, tens of thousands of people there to see her. And it's like Pride Fest, dude. It's just like, like all the gays came out, all the kids came out and her playback computer is overheating.
Oh, I've been there.
Recently, right, Chris?
Oh.
Dude, so I'm there at front of house. I'm on a raised front of house platform and she's doing the set and her playback keeps going out and everyone turns and looks at me every time her computer goes off. And I'm just like, guys, I'm not doing this on purpose. It was more funny. I'm like, what are you going to do?
So it's uncomfortable when you're in front of house and the whole crowd just kind of like turns back and looks at you like
just like a screeching halt and all eyes on you.
Like, yeah, I'm not trying to do that.
Yeah, no. Like I love her actually. Like I wish.
Oh, dude. You know, yes. Yeah. I love her.
She's great.
How she's on social media and her music.
Minneapolis, baby. Let's go.
Lizzo.
Shout out to Lizzo.
Well, on that note of fails, thank you so much for coming on, Malcolm. This has been amazing. It's so good to talk to you.
Dude. So good to
I miss
chat.
You, brother.
You boys.
I can't wait to see you on the road again soon.
Yeah, for sure. Or let's go on tour together. Maybe next year. It's great because I've seen you guys around, but I haven't actually worked a gig with you guys. So I can't wait. It'll be like Dream Team,
I know, man. Yeah.
Or a secondary podcast on Gain Structure. So we got to do that still.
There you go. I'd love to come on again. Well, maybe not be so nervous next time. Whatever. It was good. Could have been better. Could have been worse.
It was great,
whatever.
Man.
Love you did amazing.
Awesome. Oh, awesome.
Yeah. No, we'll definitely have to bring you back on. And
I really just kind of, brushed the surface on everything I've learned. And I'd love to share because I've learned from so many people who have just been open and I ask questions. And now I just give back,
Exactly. Yeah. I say the same, man. I think we've all had, at least like me, I've been lucky to have some amazing mentors. So when people approach me or I have the chance to give out information, I always dish it out. Like, here you go. This is what I've collected from my experience and I hope it helps you and pass it on.
Everyone, don't forget, we're still going to do our mentor episode where we have our mentors on. Talk about how cool. We started.
Yeah.
That's been really, really fun.
Talk about how green we were. And
I still remember my biggest fuck up was I was at a shop called VHC in Minneapolis, which was the first L-acoustics dealer in the United States, actually. And I had to wire all the fly looms for the DV-DOS rig. And I wired them all wrong.
No.
And they trusted me and they had to go up on site and rewire the looms after they had flown the PA.
dude probably hated you so bad.
He's my mentor though. He's like the front of house guy who's my mentor who I love to this day. But it was like I was 16.
Oh, they trusted a 16-year-old kid with that job?
But it's weird because they wire...
That was their mistake.
They wire in two different ways though. So I tested it and it was wired properly one way. but not the second way. And that was not...
Excuses.
And he came back to the shop and was like, look, I had to get up on a fucking chair lift and rewire every single loom. I was like,
oh, dude.
I'm so sorry, Paul.
Brutal.
But he's the guy I'm going to have on. So look forward to that, guys, too. Probably a lot of embarrassing stories.
Cool, man. Well, thank you, Malcolm. Such a pleasure to have you, man. And yeah, I hope we tour together soon, hopefully this year.
Well, touring's coming back strong. You know, when it does come back, I'm super excited. I think it's going to come back with a vengeance. And
with a force.
With a force, man. And there'll be plenty of gigs and, you know, only the best that have stuck around. So let's get it.
Let's fucking get it.
This is the way.
This is the way.
On that note, thank you for listening to the Stage Right podcast. We'll see you guys next week.
Yes.
Thank you so much for your support.
Later, guys.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. Remember to give us a like, subscribe, and a follow on Spotify, Apple Podcast, and on Instagram @StageRightPodcast. Thank you.